Hey there, it's Haley, host of this show, How We'll Live. If you've already listened to episode one, welcome back. If you're new here, welcome and thank you for taking time out of your day to hang out with me and my awesome guests. This show is all about learning new things. I knew basically nothing about most of these topics before I got started. And by the time I was finished with each conversation, I felt like my mind was open and expanded in new ways that I didn't even know was possible. And that's a pretty great feeling. So each week, I share these conversations that I'm having with thought leaders, creators, and crusaders whose innovative work, ideas, and products are igniting change, challenging the status quo, and shifting existing thought patterns for a better now and greater tomorrow. We'll discuss our health, the environment, culture, society, and how together we can make the world better and our experiences happier. My mission is to think a little bit differently, spark some passion, make change, and of course, have some fun while we're at it. So today we're talking about sleep. 7 to 9 hours. We've heard it before and we'll hear it again. We all know we need it and hardly any of us get enough. In fact, we're sleeping nearly 1 hour less than we were in the 1950s. While that might seem like a small number, it actually has a profound impact on our health. Today, I am talking with sleep expert Dan Gartenberg. Dan has a PhD in cognitive psychology. He's a TED resident, assistant adjunct professor at Penn State, and CEO of Proactive Life LLC, where he's developing the Sonic Sleep Coach software platform, which uses smartphone and Internet of Things technology to accurately detect sleep and make it more regenerative. Dr. Gartenberg is currently executing grants to validate this technology from the National Science Foundation and National Institute of Health. Yes, Dan is a super smart guy, but beyond all of his professional accolades, Dan is just a really awesome person. This was such a fun conversation to have, and I am so excited to share it with you. During the show, you'll hear why the thing we do for one-third of our life impacts everything from our health to our relationships, why sleep is basically related to all health ailments and some chronic disease, what the heck a Zeitgeber is, why you might be binging on chips or Ben & Jerry's at midnight, what's actually happening when you dream, his tips for a better night's sleep, and so much more. If you like what you hear on today's show, I would love if you rated, left a review, subscribed, or downloaded, whatever feels right for you. And if you think something could be better, please shoot me an email to haley@haley-miller.com. My goal is for this show to be awesome. So if you have feedback or there's someone you would love to hear from, definitely let me know. I'm all ears. Anyways, let's get to my conversation with Dan. Dan, thank you so much for sitting down and talking with me today. I think that this is going to be an informative conversation for me. And as we were talking about earlier, I could use a little sleep help myself, and I'm sure I'm not the only one. So super excited to sit down and talk with you.
Thanks. I'm so happy to be here. Appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah. So you are a researcher, a scientist, a coach, an entrepreneur, a TED speaker, but I am sure that talking about sleep and sleep science hasn't always been your so-called dream, pun intended. So tell me your story. How did you get started along this path?
Yeah, so I guess it was around 10 years ago now. Wow. So I was always sort of an inventor by nature. And as an intern in college, I had this job for a brainstorming company. And my job was literally to sort through hundreds of their ideas. One of the ideas was actually for an alarm clock that could measure people's sleep on an iPhone. So this was like right when the iPhone was coming out. And I sort of ran with that for, 10 years now. I won this engineering competition at Wisconsin. We made the app. And I sort of realized that to really improve people's sleep, and what excited me about this is that sleep is literally the human behavior that we do the most of. So sort of what focused me on this topic for so long is if you could just improve people's sleep quality, 2 to 3%, it would basically have a massive global health impact on the world. I realized after studying this and in my PhD work, I needed to really understand this more. So I ended up getting a PhD in cognitive psychology. And so cognitive psychology sort of takes a different perspective to artificial intelligence than a lot of people think of when they think of artificial intelligence. So instead of trying to basically map how to optimize a problem, we actually create software that replicates how the human deals with the situation. So in my dissertation, I focused on basically how to model human fatigue and alertness, and you know how being sleep deprived impacts like every aspect of cognition. It's related to a ton of chronic health ailments, basically all of them. And so, I basically just ran with it from there.
When did you say, wow, this is a huge problem? Because I think sleep is being talked about more and more, but it's really an epidemic.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically 10 years ago, when I wanted to really dive into this, I took a course taught by a very famous professor in the sleep world, Julian Tononi, who came up with this revolutionary theory about sleep. I took his course at University of Wisconsin, and that basically changed my whole perspective on this stuff. You know, how he described, you know, the circadian rhythm. I didn't know much about it at the time. Sleep need, or in the sleep science world, is called the homeostatic component of sleep, which is a fancy way of saying your sleep need. One of the fun things about sleep is there's all these kind of weird words that I wish were in the common like vernacular of our society, because they really convey a lot of like what's going on to our bodies throughout the day, for why we're tired, you know, how we can improve our exercise, why we're binging on this, you know, food at a certain time. Just a couple of those words.
Hear them. I want to hear the words, and I want to break them down okay. So that we can, because I think my biggest thing is there's so many things that we can improve, but if we don't really know why, how are we actually going to do it, right? Like, I hear the word circadian rhythm. I hear the word REM cycle. Yeah. I hear the words deep sleep, but I'm like, okay, I hear those. I know they're related to sleep, but I don't know what they actually mean. Mm-hmm. So Dan, tell us what they are and why.
Oh my gosh. I'll try to unpack this, but sleep is basically composed of two main rhythms, your sleep need and your circadian rhythm. So basically, we evolved actually from bacteria in the ocean that could differentiate sunlight from darkness. And so every organism that survives for more than 24 hours a day has a circadian rhythm that's based on differentiating light, basically. And so your circadian rhythm is impacted by this weird German word, which I would like to bring into the vernacular, which is called Zeitgebers. That's German for
Zeitgebers.
Yes.
Okay. We're going to need a dictionary.
It actually means, in German, it means timekeeper.
Okay.
And so the biggest Zeitgeber that impacts your circadian rhythm is sunlight. So getting exposure to sunlight in the morning and not getting that exposure in the nighttime. But also, even like timings of when you socialize with people, when you eat meals, when you spend energy, when you exercise. These are all cues to your body for when you should be awake and when you should be asleep. And so also what's impacted by this is something called chronobiology. And so that's basically the science of how you have a certain time in the day to be most active. And there's genes that dictate this too. So like, for example, 30% of people have genes that make them more likely to be a morning person.
Is that a lark?
Yes, so that's a lark. You got that one. And then everyone knows the night owls.
Right.
That's also like 30%. And then you kind of have people that are more malleable, and they're largely malleable based on these Zeitgebers, the biggest one being sunlight.
Okay. Think I got it. So that was all within talking about the circadian rhythm.
That's all circadian.
Okay.
So now we can shift to sleep need, or the homeostatic component of sleep.
Okay.
So one of the big questions I get asked a lot is, how much sleep do people need? Mm-hmm. So basically, a group of scientists got together recently, and they said that adults need, on the minimum, 7 hours a night on a regular basis, but it can be anywhere from 7 to 9 hours. And so part of the difficulty in answering this question of how much sleep you need is everyone's a little bit different. But there's one thing that we do know, which is that every single animal on the planet sleeps. There's also even some evidence that like plants sleep. So like there's something going on here where, you know, we can evolve in all these different ways, but for whatever reason, we always end up evolving to needing to sleep. And that question of why, like there's probably many reasons why, you know, one of them is to get predators at a certain time. One is to preserve energy. The one that I think is most captivating is this idea called the synaptic homeostasis hypothesis for why we need to sleep. And this is what Julian Tononi, my professor, coined this theory. And it's basically the idea that during the day, you form all these excitatory connections with the world around you. And it results in overall higher activation of the neurons in your brain. But you don't need all that information. Like you only need the stuff that's relevant to your survival. So it used to be that, you know, you'd have to process that the lions are in this part of the forest, right? Now it's sort of more along the lines of like, what did my best friend say about me on Instagram or something like this? Mm-hmm. So whatever's most relevant to your survival, you know, you want to process that information more than what's not relevant. And what this theory says is that during deep sleep, basically your brain down-regulates all those connections such that the things that are most relevant to your survival rise to the top. And then during REM, you basically replay that information. So you encode it into your long-term memory and save it for when it's useful for you later. So basically, sleep is how we process information, is an easier way to think about it.
Through those two ways.
Yeah, so down-regulated. Well, this is...
Oh, okay. We're still in...
Now we're in homeostasis.
Okay.
That's sleep need. And so that's why we have these weird sleep cycles. It usually goes light sleep, deep sleep, light sleep, REM. Light sleep, deep sleep, light sleep, REM. And you get less and less deep sleep as the night goes on.
How many times do you go through that cycle?
It's typically 4 to 5 times. But like when we run our studies, like I look at people's brainwaves while they're sleeping, and it's much more erratic than you're taught in your basic health or psychology classes. Like I could easily go from REM to deep sleep or REM to, like, it's not very predictable sometimes.
Interesting. So what exactly are each of those phases, light sleep, deep sleep, and REM? And is one like better for us than the other? What's happening during each of them?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is like a really complicated question. This question is like, what is sleep? And they don't really know totally the answer to that yet. I mean, we really only discovered REM like 70, 80 years ago. So sleep is actually sort of a recent discovery in science. We know unequivocally that REM is a distinct process from the other stages, because you can really see clearly indicators of it, like your eyes move around, you know, rapid eye movement. You're actually physically paralyzed when you're in REM sleep. And so like if you have something like sleep paralysis, that's when you like wake up during this period of being paralyzed. I don't know if you've ever.
That's so scary. Yeah. I feel like that's probably happened to me like a couple of times when I've woken up and
it's very stressful.
Yeah. I don't think it lasted a long time though.
Yeah. Some people get it all the time. It's really interesting. Sleep opens up all these different windows into the human consciousness. But a lot of people think that abduction, like alien abduction stories, all kind of come from the psychological phenomenon of sleep paralysis. Because a common thing in sleep paralysis is that you sense a presence in the room. Usually it's an old hag. And like everyone that has sleep paralysis experiences this. It's
really? That there's a presence in the room with
yeah.
them?
Yeah. Sometimes it can be pretty scary. Like my buddy has this one where some guy is like facing away from him in like a fedora or something. And
really?
Just like standing there. But it's very common to have a hallucination like that when you're in sleep paralysis for whatever reason.
That's really, seems like it'd be really scary. Yeah. So I haven't had sleep paralysis in that way. There's been no man in a fedora in my bedroom, which is good. Wow. Okay. Interesting.
So that's REM, and there's a lot of stuff related to REM. There's some evidence that you could actually encode memories through REM by processing when you get exposed to and this is something I've explored in my research, when you basically process information with an odor and then replay that odor in REM, it can prime you to that and you could have a better memory recall for it. That's kind of like a crazy new futuristic thing that I'm working on to try to get people to mold their minds how they want to mold their minds. The other part...
That sounds controversial.
Yeah, that's far out there in the pipeline of what we're building. But you'd have to make sure that you did that in the right way. As you can imagine, people could get a little freaked out by that.
Depends how people want to mold their minds, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you can mold your mind to eat healthier foods. That's the way that I like to think about it. But
not world domination.
Not to whisper in people's ear, Dan is a great scientist or something like
yeah.
that. But so that's REM. And then the other part of sleep, this question of what is sleep, is deep sleep and light sleep is a simple way to put it. And as humans, we just like to create categories for things because it makes us feel like we have control. But when you look at this scientifically, deep sleep and light sleep really function on a gradient. There's certain indicators of when you're in deep sleep, like sleep spindles, but you don't have to get this a nuance. But basically, Europe has 4 stages of light sleep, deep sleep. The US has 3 stages of light sleep, deep sleep. Even the scientific community doesn't agree on exactly how to categorize this. And the reason is, it's a false category. It basically functions on a gradient. But as you get older, you get less and less deep sleep. And deep sleep is what we think of as that consolidation of memory. So basically, you're able to process less new information as you get older, which is indicative of the fact that your brain waves have less deep sleep. So you're producing less of these long brain waves. And that's what we study in our lab, is to basically figure out a way through sounds to get people to produce more of these regenerative deep sleep brain waves, which has been associated with cell recovery, memory processing, basically a bunch of healthy outcomes for your next day.
And that happens during the deep sleep.
Yes.
Cool.
Delta.
So delta deep sleep.
Yes.
That's how I'm going to remember it.
Yes.
Yeah. That's so interesting. And it's interesting that it's not as effective as we get older. So is that, we're sleeping less probably as we get older. Maybe we have more stressors that cause us to not have those significant brain waves. And how does that affect our experiences in life as we get older? If we're getting less sleep, are there further implications, to our health?
Yeah. I mean, that's a really complicated question. So unequivocally, by the time you're, 70, you're sleeping almost an hour less than when you're, our age, 30s range. It's unclear whether your brain just naturally does that or if it's these other health outcomes that are making you sleep less. So figuring out what's causing what is something that's a little bit tricky. Clearly when you're older, you're on all these medications, which might naturally make you produce less of these deep sleep brain waves. And they think it might be also related to Alzheimer's. The quality of your sleep has shown some relationships with this. Really, to understand this sleep need, how much sleep should you get? I would basically say that, and I think most, this is still a controversy in the literature. There was an argument about this at the least recent sleep conference. And the question is almost can you oversleep? And this is kind of get at these other factors that can impact this question. So there are studies that show that sleeping more results in increased morbidity, a greater likelihood that you're going to die. The issue is if you have an infection, for example, you naturally sleep more. Mm-hmm. So they do these studies where they'll, show that sleeping more results in a greater likelihood of dying. But then once you control for all these other things, if you have an infection and whatnot, then the relationship basically goes away. So figuring out the causal mechanism here is really important. And so based on, you know, what I've seen, I would basically say that you can't oversleep, maybe unless you're depressed. But basically, if you're sleeping, your body is probably doing it for a reason. And I've even seen some research showing that even if you're sleeping like 7 hours, which is usually a healthy amount of sleep, most Americans sleep 7 hours, even sleeping a half hour more can have all these causal, you can show causally your hypertension goes down, your blood pressure goes down. A lot of stuff with the cardiovascular system has a very causal relationship with this. Even sleeping a little extra than what is thought to be healthy can help a lot of these health indicators.
Interesting. Yeah. Cause I definitely have heard the rumor. I say to a friend, oh, I'm so tired today, or I slept so much last night. And they're like, oh, well, that's probably why you're tired, because right. you overslept or you slept too much.
Yeah. And everyone has that perception. And I think that's why some apps out there that wake you up in like a lighter sleep cycle, why a lot of people think that they work. But I've made an app like that in the past, actually, and I took it off of the app store because I realized that it was a little bit negligent. Like, you should almost always sleep more. And so probably that perception, and so the way we wake people up with our app Sonic Sleep is we actually wake them up very, very gradually. So we'll wake you up over like a 10-minute period. So when you're sleep deprived, you'll get wake up in minute 9 because it's so gradual. If you're not, you'll wake up in like minute 2.
It's like a built-in snooze button.
Yes. And also it reduces the likelihood of you disturbing your sleep partner because it's basically the minimum sound dosage necessary to wake you up.
Interesting. Yeah, a sleep partner is interesting too because you almost lose control over your sleep. Maybe they had it right back in the 50s when they slept in
No, and beds. Actually in the Netherlands, it's very common to have different blankets. And that's actually something I often recommend to my clients. Dealing with the temperature needs of your sleep partner is oftentimes an issue because if you're, you know, women, for example, naturally run colder than men. Mm. So they'll usually want more blankets. There's this device that I'm playing with right now called Chili Pad that we're working to integrate our sleep detection system on. Mm-hmm. And actually can control the temperature on the left and the right side of the bed.
Interesting.
Which is kind of a cool thing.
That is cool. I mean, temperature, I know for me, has such an impact on how I sleep. You know, I was in Tulum in a hotel with no air conditioning. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I slept because it was so humid. It was so hot. But I think you can tell me if this is typical for people, but having some kind of weight on you when you sleep feels nice and can help with sleep. Have you guys found that?
Yeah, they have these weighted blankets. We haven't explored that in our lab. We mainly explore sound, light, and temperature. Those are the big things we think about. So basically, quiet environment, no light, cool, are important to improve your sleep quality. And if you just control those things, you're going to have a better night's sleep and it's going to be really healthy for you. Mm-hmm. I think about sleep as more important than diet and exercise, because if you're sleep deprived, you're not going to be able to work out as hard. You're going to want more fatty foods. So it's almost like the prerequisite to a healthy lifestyle, I think, is sleep. And then these other things come after it. Mm-hmm. It's the way I think about health a lot of times.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense for me. I know when I get poor night's sleep, which is probably more often than I would like, I definitely crave more food. I feel like I could be hungry all day. And, you know, you go to work out and you feel lethargic, and then it becomes this ongoing cycle of poor sleep continuously. So 7 to 9 hours, that's the golden rule, I guess. And you mentioned that genetics can play a role. How does that work? And how do we find out, like, what do my genetics say about my sleep?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple easy ways to figure out your sleep need and your genetics. You can do 23andMe and it'll tell you if you're more likely to be a morning person or an evening person. And there are a very, very small percentage of our society that are known as short sleepers that can get by on more like 5 hours, but that's pretty rare. What I would say, if you wanted to figure out how much sleep you actually need, is imagine sleeping. What amount would you need to not feel tired during the day? I know that sounds like a simplistic thing. There's sort of a hack to doing this too, because a lot of times like stressful work environments can mess with understanding this whole process. So what I recommend to some of my clients is leading up to a vacation, try to go to bed at the same time every day. And then when you go on the vacation, continue with that pattern. And on the vacation, you have none of these external stressors that are pushing you to wake up. And that natural amount of sleep is probably close to how much sleep you actually need.
But what about, I'm thinking, you know, I've had times where I've gotten 6 hours of sleep and I powered through my day. Am I kind of going against my natural rhythm and going against nature? Or, you know, I know people can develop adrenal fatigue by doing that. And there are a lot of implications of it. So, but I'm tricking myself to thinking that I'm able to get by.
I would say yes. I mean, I think that's the perception that people have of sleeping less and feeling more awake. It has probably to do with two things. First, based on your circadian rhythm, you have a time that's best for you to wake up in the day. We have some technology to try to help people figure that out. But like, for example, I'm like a night owl. Like my time to wake up is probably between like 8 and 9, frankly, because I'll stay up late and do like an iteration of work sometimes at night. If I were to shift my bedtime to be like much later and then sleep in later, that would be off for me. I'd get worse sleep quality. And if I were to like sleep, you know, way later than that or wake up earlier than that, it might throw me off. So there's like a time based on your 24-hour rhythm that's best for you to wake up. The other thing is if you have to wake up early for whatever reason, a lot of times there's like some external thing that's really getting your like cortisol going. That's what wakes you up. It doesn't have to do with sleep. It's just like you have external stressors that are overriding your need to sleep. But that doesn't mean that you still don't need to get that amount of sleep, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely makes sense. I have stress wake me up all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah. So in thinking about the circadian rhythm, it sounds like everybody's circadian rhythm is personal to them. Has it always been that way? Or I guess when I think of circadian rhythm, I think of the sun and the sunlight. So how does that relate to, or am I totally off? Circadian rhythm is the sun.
No, yeah. The main thing that dictates your circadian rhythm is the sun. There's other things too, like the Zeitgebers. Going back to the Zeitgebers.
Wait, define Zeitgebers again?
The timekeeper.
Timekeeper.
It's like cues that tell your body what time it is.
Okay.
So like they've done these crazy studies where they figure out what the circadian rhythm is by like the first study, they put two researchers in this cave that was completely dark for like 3 weeks or something. And they saw when they naturally woke up and went to bed. And they actually, the human circadian rhythm is a little less than 24 hours. It's like 23 and a half hours. This is population-wise. It gets complicated because everyone's a little different.
Right.
And actually, even within you, you can be different. So like, for example, school start times are basically at the exact worst time for people's naturally occurring circadian rhythms. Because when you're a teenager, for whatever reason, your circadian rhythm naturally gets pushed to be later. Some people theorize that this is to try to get teenagers to break away from their parents a little bit, maybe as like a socialization thing. So like even across your lifespan, and you know, like the early bird special for older people, like even across a person's lifespan, their circadian rhythm will shift. And then even within yourself, within like the year, you can shift your circadian rhythm by giving yourself exposure to sunlight at certain times, eating meals at certain times, exercising at certain times, and going to bed at certain times.
Huh. So is that why we're sitting with this little, we have a sunlight machine sitting here. I don't know exactly what it's called.
Yeah. So this is a 10,000 lux lamp that emulates the sun. And, you know, sometimes I'm indoors, you know, just working all day and I don't get enough sunlight. So just like while I eat breakfast, I'll turn this on for 10 minutes and it gives my body the cue that it needs to know that now it's time to be alert and like seize the day.
I like that. Seize the day.
Carpe diem.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So if I live in New York, I work a 9-to-5 job. What would be ideal for setting my circadian rhythm in terms of
time going to bed, waking up, when's best to exercise, and the types of food that could be best for me in order to promote a good night's sleep. I know that it's personal, you know, because yeah. everyone has their own dietary needs and stuff, but just in generalization.
So like usually if I were to like ask someone to try to shift to be more of a morning person, which a lot of people usually want to do, having a consistent bedtime based on their sleep need, you know, first off, making sure that they get enough sleep, figuring out what their sleep need is. So say yours was, I don't know, what do you think your sleep need is?
12. No, I'm just joking. 8. I think it's 8.
Yeah, maybe. Most people, I'm around 8.
Okay.
I would say like 30 to 40% of the population usually needs closer to 8. Also, to get 8, sometimes you need to spend more time in bed because you're not spending 100% of that time in bed asleep. So, for example, if you say 8 hours, you know, and you have to wake up at what, 7:30?
Mm-hmm.
Then you would probably, you know, try to go to bed at like 11-ish and then really stick to that. Now, if you were someone that had trouble falling asleep and staying asleep, there's another bunch of things that I would suggest to those people, because when you have insomnia, a lot of times you end up associating being awake in bed, and you actually, in those cases, often you would want to restrict the amount of time in bed. So the time that you spent in bed, you spend sleeping. So it's a little counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm.
That's known as sleep restriction therapy, actually.
Okay.
That's an aspect of cognitive behavioral therapy. I would only recommend that if someone has tried a lot of other things and it hasn't worked. By the way, I'm a cognitive psychologist, not a clinician. So see your doctor about this stuff if you think you have insomnia, or sleep apnea is another major thing that a lot of people have. But back to you. So I would basically use this happy lamp in the morning, or better yet, just go for a walk outside if you can in the morning. You can't always do that. Eating breakfast is another thing that you can do to become more of a morning person. You know, usually the best time to exercise, you have what's called sleep inertia in the morning. So usually for about an hour after you wake up, you're fatigued. So maybe expending energy in the morning, like exercising, is another thing you can do to shift yourself to be more of a morning person. And then not eating like too close to dinner time. I would need to ask you like a lot of questions to give you more customized feedback.
Okay.
But that's the gist of it.
Got it.
And then another thing is, I actually think for optimum productivity, just resting your eyes for like 20 minutes during your circadian dip. So like, for example, for you, if you were wake up at like 8-ish, you probably, based on a circadian rhythm around that time, most people would probably have like a peak alertness from like 10 to lunchtime.
Mm-hmm.
Like an hour to two after lunchtime, it's very typical to have what's known as a circadian dip. So that's like the afternoon, you want to grab that coffee. Coffee has a very long half-life, so it's probably better not to grab that coffee. Just stick to the coffee in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even realize it, even if it doesn't disturb your sleep, it impacts your sleep quality. And I think you said on the walk over here that you don't drink coffee after noon, which is smart.
I really try not to, because I am a pretty light sleeper. I'll wake up at least once during the night, and then I find it hard to fall back asleep sometimes, especially when I'm in moments of having a little bit more anxiety.
Yeah.
So it's definitely dependent, but I think that it definitely affects my sleep, even if I don't realize it.
Yeah, that's the thing. Even if you're not conscious of the fact that it's impacting your sleep, they've done studies to show it makes your sleep lighter. Mm-hmm. And really what we're trying to do here is make you get more out of the sleep that you're getting. So like 7 hours of sleep isn't always equal to 7 hours of sleep. You can get a better 7 hours or a worse 7 hours. So that's all about trying to reduce your awakenings. And actually the brain will wake up even without you being aware of it from like sounds.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing we're trying to do with our research is create this technology to block out the sounds that wake you up and then play other noises that actually make you sleep, have more of these deep sleep delta waves.
So if I wake up in the morning and it's, you know, 7 a.m., I feel like I've gotten pretty good night's sleep and I still feel that sleep inertia, like you mentioned, is that normal to feel sleep inertia and feel a little fatigued for an hour and I kind of just have to push myself past it? Or how do I know if I just haven't gotten enough sleep?
If you have bad sleep inertia, it's an indicator that you didn't get enough sleep. If you slept enough, you're going to have less sleep inertia. The more sleep deprived you are, the worse your sleep inertia, basically. There's a few other hacks to try to counteract it. And this is going to sound really silly and simple, but they've done some research actually where just splashing cold water on your face can address it. It's kind of like giving your body like a fight or flight response system, like a jolt to wake up. I mean, obviously like the coffee in the morning and then also the sunlight.
Okay, cool. So setting some of those habits can be helpful in overcoming those feelings in the morning and sort of pushing yourself to becoming a morning person.
Yeah, I mean, the more consistent you are with these things, the more entrenched your circadian rhythm and the more consolidated your sleep will be. That's the other hack that I give to a lot of people is that the more consistent your habits, the more regenerative your sleep is. Because like if I were to sleep 7 hours at an irregular time versus if I were to sleep 7 hours at my normal time, you'd naturally get better sleep if you sleep at your normal time because your body knows to sleep at that time and processes the world that way.
Hmm. So interesting. There's so many different factors, I feel, that go into having this good night's sleep. And you started talking about closing your eyes in the middle of the day. So is Dan giving everyone permission to take a nap at work? Or what do you think about?
I want to change the way that the workplace operates because I truly believe, you know, especially when we're dealing with increasingly more like cerebral jobs, taking that 20-minute nap during your circadian dip, which is usually around 2 hours. Sorry, I got off track before, I guess. But it's usually around 2 hours after lunch you have this dip. Instead of taking the coffee, doing a little, I like to do this, do a little 20-minute nap. If I slept enough, I don't need to do it. But if I had like maybe a crummy night's sleep or something, it's also good to have that out in your mind that if you do have a crummy night's sleep, you can take this nap that's going to let you fight through the rest of the day. Stick to like 20 minutes. You don't want to do it much later than 4 because it can mess with your sleep the rest of the day. But I'm actually trying to go to these companies, creating these like nap situations for companies and trying to show them that they can get more out of their workers by just getting them to relax more. Like I basically feel like, you know, with the squeezing of the middle class that's happened and all this other stuff, and companies are working their employees to death sometimes in some instances. And it's actually a lot of times at the detriment to the company. Because when your workers are sleep deprived, they're going to make errors, accidents. You lose empathy when you're sleep deprived, so you're not going to be able to work well with each other. And if you're like a computer programmer, for example, I work with a lot of computer programmers as an entrepreneur, a lot of times you'll have this thing where you'll have an intractable problem. You'll take a 20-minute nap, you'll wake up and you'll solve the problem. It's really good for getting people to not fixate and think divergently because it's like sleep is very different from the metaphor that I think a lot of Americans have for health. Like the stricter I am with the diet, the better the outcomes, the harder I push with my workout, the, you know, buffer I'll get or whatever. Sleep, it's more about letting go and knowing how to let go, knowing how to de-stress. Like the harder you try to sleep, the harder it is to fall asleep. That's the ironic thing about it. So yeah, so I'm sorry. Sometimes I go on these garden paths.
No, but I like it because I like it to learn more.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely feel the harder you try, the harder it is to fall asleep. For example, last night I woke up in the middle of the night, started thinking about things, was anxious, and my ability to fall back asleep, it was so hard because I was like, I'm never going to fall back asleep. Try some deep breathing. You know, it became so challenging. So that's definitely interesting. What about, though, meditation as opposed to a nap? Are there similarities? What's the difference? Because I know a lot of people are promoting meditation too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not against meditation. I mean, if you meditate properly, you're producing a lot of the same brain waves as light sleep, theta waves, basically. I would love to run this study one day, but I have a very strong suspicion that a 20-minute nap is more regenerative than a 20-minute meditation in many ways, mm-hmm. for your health, for your cognition. So, you know, it's becoming more socially acceptable to like meditate at work. I want it to be socially acceptable to take a cat nap at work. I would love to live in a society that enabled that. And I mean, they do it in Europe and with siestas and whatnot. It's used to be more common.
Right. Siestas are a thing for a reason.
For a reason, exactly. And if they have these crazy experiments where they study indigenous tribes, like this is the way that we were programmed to sleep, with basically taking an afternoon nap, is a very common thing for indigenous tribes to do.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess the way that we live our lives today, and I think it's an epidemic everywhere in the country, but especially in big cities like New York, where you have, you know, I had a friend who told me a story the other day where her husband got an email at 11 p.m. asking for a project, and he was sleeping, and he was sleeping until 7:30 in the morning the next day. And at 7 a.m., he had an email saying, like, why isn't this done?
Yeah.
You know, and so there's this societal pressure to be constantly connected.
Yes.
And like, what are your thoughts around that in sleep?
Yeah. I mean, so I think this is why sleep is worse than it's been since the 50s. I mean, and it's gotten a lot worse in the past 20 years, is that these devices make our brain, like we're always a little bit on with our cell phones. We're always processing information at any possible time. People don't know how to like disassociate from their technology and turn off. That's why, you know, we make sure that our technology works with even a situation where you put the phone outside of the bedroom. I mean, that could be a useful thing to actually partition off that space. This is my sleep time now. Mm-hmm. Being able to let go of technology is a major issue. I can't even imagine, like, I'm not a Generation Z person. Like, I feel like my younger siblings, like, are even more addicted to this technology than I am. You know, definitely don't sleep with your phone in your bed. Not good. Also, the blue light from the phone isn't the best. Another hack out there is to use Flux or True Dark glasses. If, for example, I have a client that likes to go on their iPad, and I'll recommend to him, look, I get that you like to go on your iPad sometimes when you wake up in the middle of the night. You don't necessarily have to change that, but at least put on these glasses that prevent the light from disrupting your circadian rhythm. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, the other thing about all these devices, if anything, we're processing so much more information than we were in the 50s. We're constantly getting bombarded with this information. And I think really the challenge of our generation is knowing what is meaningful in all of this information. And this gets to the essence of what sleep is actually, because sleep is how we process meaning out of our daily lives. So if anything, I think nowadays we need to sleep more because we're processing so much more information actually.
Right. In a more cognitive way, like you were saying before, people were working with their hands more. There wasn't as much brain activity in the same way. And we were talking about this on the walk over too. You know, I'm trying so hard to break this habit, but I wake up in the morning and I roll over and I want to scroll through Instagram, and it's such a habit, you know, and then I'm consuming information from this right before I go to bed until the minute I wake up in the morning. And often what I'm consuming through Instagram or email or Twitter or whatever can also be stress inducing. You know, mm-hmm. if I'm watching the news or I'm on Instagram, which creates this culture of comparison yeah. and work email, you know, it's constant anxiety and stress. And I don't think I want those things encoded into me when I'm sleeping.
No. Yeah. I mean, the whole stress aspect, look, if you're stressed, you're going to have worse sleep quality too. This also happens a lot of times for like recent parents, like their fight or flight system is always just a little bit on because you got to always listen to your kid yelling. I think the phones are kind of similar to that. Like when you're always connected with your technology, your fight or flight response is always just a little bit activated, and that's going to drain you even if you're not that consciously aware of it. And it could, you know, hinder your sleep quality for sure.
Mm-hmm. What are some tips that you give to your clients? You know, I work a stressful job. That's the reality, you know, and I still want to exercise and go out and be social with my friends. Like I want to kind of do everything. What are some tips or hacks that you give to sort of wind down and de-stress?
Yeah, it's a good, I mean, some of this is just cognitive restructuring or getting people to think differently about things. Like, I think our society has really pushed forward this idea of exercising all the time. And I think oftentimes it's going to be better to go to the sauna, you know, have a decompressing ritual in your toolbox, whatever relaxes you. I mean, frankly, it could be video games sometimes, you know what I mean? Or watching TV, which isn't the best, most effective way of doing it. I mean, if you were like a rich person or something, I would say like try these sensory deprivation chambers, which can do wonders, really, with like getting people to block out all the stimulation in their lives. One of the things that we have is in our app is progressive muscle relaxation. And so this has been shown to be one of the most effective ways to relax the mind. And the reason I like it is because you can actually do it while you're in bed. And it's very simple. After you do it a couple times, you can kind of just do it yourself. And what you do is you tense different muscles going through, like tensing your forearm. And so there's like a physical aspect to it and also a mental aspect. And again, you're just doing that. You're not forcing yourself to try to fall asleep. You'll just like naturally wander off into sleep doing a meditation like that sometimes.
That's so interesting. So tell me more about your research and your apps and all the awesome stuff that you're doing, because you've given us so much information on sleep. And I know that your knowledge comes from all of this work that you've done and are continuously doing.
Yeah, thanks. I'd love to talk about it. So, you know, basically, when I was in my PhD program, I was making apps and I was working for a major device, Fortune 500 company, that had a watch on the store. And I was making an algorithm for them. And I sort of realized that you really can't get accurate measure of sleep with motion alone, is a realization that I came to. And so when the Apple Watch came out, that sort of reinvigorated a lot of my interest in this space, because I knew that with heart rate, I could get a very accurate measure of what someone's sleep quality actually is. So we ended up applying for these grants from the National Science Foundation, National Institute of Health, where we basically hooked people up to the best wearables on the market. The two ones that we really focused on the study were Apple Watch and this device called the Oura Ring, which we really like, and we validated the accuracy of the sensor. And so we'll hook them up to the best wearables. Some of them are clinical grade. And then we'll bring people into a lab at Penn State. I work with a professor there, Orfeo Buxton, and hook them up to polysomnography, which is another one of these sleep words. It's basically electrodes that measure your brain waves. And we'll hook them up all to these devices, and then we'll play sounds at them while they're sleeping that prime these deep sleep brain states. And we've actually shown that we can increase the percentage of time that people spend in deep sleep, because we don't want to just track people's sleep. And, you know, with these devices, we can actually get, we think it's better accuracy than your Fitbit at measuring your sleep. But it's one thing to just track people's sleep. Like, what am I going to really do with the fact that my Fitbit says that I slept 30 minutes in deep sleep? Sometimes that makes me anxious. Like, there's not much action I can take with that. What I want to do is actually improve your sleep quality in real time by playing sounds that block out noise pollution, making your sleep deeper with deep sleep stimulation, having an alarm clock that wakes you up at the right time, and then maybe even doing some stuff with interacting with how you encode information through dreams. Take all that data in. We do our machine learning on the motion and heart rate data, accurately display your sleep, and then give you customized feedback like I do in my coaching sessions, but in an automated fashion. And we're releasing this thing. We have an app on the store right now called Sonic Sleep Coach, and we're releasing the full product in early next year in 2019.
That is so exciting. And it feels like that information, it's actionable. You know, I've used things before, and I guess it's, you know, in even the steps, you get all of this data and you're sort of like, what do I do with it? And we were talking about data and science and using it to really like shape a story and shape stories on a personal level. And it feels like this information can be so impactful for people because it takes, you know, I was asking you these questions and you're like, well, I can't answer them for you without knowing way more about you.
Exactly. What we try to motivate is 5 days of data collection, because we think that's what we really need to answer all the questions that I would ask you in like a coaching session. And then based on that, we'll give you like 3 actionable things that you can do. Best things for you, your personal 3 best things that you can do. Like everyone, I think, has like the one thing that they can do to improve. Like just theoretically, take a step back here. I think theoretically, everyone has like one thing that they could do to improve their health. That's the easiest thing to do and will have the best outcome. Let's just start with those things first. So like if it's a sleep quality thing, maybe it's getting the 10,000 lux light exposure. If it's that we detect, the app detects that you're waking up a lot in the night, maybe it's see your general practitioner and get tested for apnea. We could have a whole detect conversation about apnea too, if you wanted, because that's a whole nother topic on this space.
How many people are suffering from apnea?
So it's very under detected, under diagnosed. It's about 10% of the population.
What happens when people have apnea?
So there's basically 2 types of apnea. There's central and obstructive. 99% of people have obstructive. And it's basically the soft palate in their throat blocks their breathing. The diagnosis is your brain will wake up more than 6 times an hour, basically. And you'll have no conscious awareness of these awakenings at all. If you have a severe case of apnea, it can be like 30 to 50 times your brain, you're just constantly waking up and you won't be aware of this at all. It's crazy. Like in our lab, we'll see people's brains. You could literally like, people are really bad at evaluating what's happening when they're asleep. We'll literally like play sounds screaming at people. No conscious awareness at all.
Really?
So like people don't know what's going on when they're asleep. People that have obstructive sleep apnea might not even know it. I mean, if you are a really loud snorer, that's a symptom. Sometimes when you grind your teeth, that's a symptom. Overweight is a symptom for it. But they've done some studies where they've basically shown it decreases your life expectancy probably about 4 years if you go untreated for it.
Wow. And it's underdiagnosed.
It's very underdiagnosed. And one thing that I just want to tell people is I think most people associate the treatment with a CPAP, that big Darth Vader mask that you've probably seen. Yeah. And you can imagine like the compliance for that is not great. Like it's only 40% for good reason.
And the compliance from your sleep partner.
Yeah. And also, well, actually, usually the sleep partner is happy because before that, the person was snoring like a banshee.
Right.
But I just want to tell people if they think they might have this, and a lot of times the doctor won't bring this up, is, and you can bring this up with your doctor, sometimes you can get a mouth plate that actually shifts your jaw forward if you have a mild form of obstructive apnea that your dentist would make. You'd actually go to your dentist about this. And that is another way to solve the problem.
I'm not sure if you're a Friends fan or not.
Yeah.
But there was an episode of Friends where Joey or Chandler has to get the mouth guard because they have sleep apnea.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's a great example of TV actually helping educate us right there.
Yeah, for sure. So let's say I'm in my regular day and I want to set up a room or set up my life for the best sleep hygiene possible. How would you describe sleep hygiene to people and how can they set themselves up to have good sleep hygiene to increase the quality and maybe quantity if they need it of their sleep?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, so what I said before with creating a dark, cold environment that has no noise is a very easy way to improve your sleep quality. So one thing we do is in our app, we have something called a sound blanket. So it basically, what wakes people up when they're asleep is abrupt sounds. And so by playing like pink noise, basically, it's a type of white noise that captures more frequencies from the environment. Just playing this noise continuously throughout the night can make you have a more regenerative sleep. Clinically, when you talk about sleep hygiene, that's like a clinical term. Other things that it has to do with is no coffee, you know, close to bedtime. Don't eat too close to bedtime. People might not realize this, but if you elevate your body temperature a lot close to bedtime, that can be an issue.
So like a nighttime shower.
So nighttime shower, this is another little hack I'll throw at your viewers, is if you're a nighttime shower person, what you're going to want to do is actually in the last minute of the shower, turn it all the way down and do it, make it cold, lower that body temperature before you fall asleep. And there's actually an FDA approved product that has to do with this, is lowering your body temperature before you go to sleep helps people fall asleep, basically. So definitely not having too hot of a sleep environment. If you have an issue with your sleep partner fighting over temperature, I have this blog post called Split Blankets, Not Beds. So just like setting up that, I mean, your bed is the time that you're spending so much of your time. Just make sure that that environment is relaxing. Obviously, no TV. That's a big part of this, is you want your bed to, what they say in the, as a clinician, is save your bed for sleep and sex. I don't know if you've
heard, heard that before.
So basically, no TV. You don't want your phone around.
No eating in bed.
No eating in bed. And also having like a ritual, maybe. Like, so it's hard for me to give feedback because some people are so different. The racing mind issue is a thing that comes up a lot. For that situation, sometimes I'll recommend that people do the ritual of writing everything they have to do the next day, like partitioning out what that anxiety is coming from. I mean, this doesn't apply if it's something more personal, but if it's like a work-related mind racing, partitioning out some time, maybe like an hour before you go to bed, to do your to-do list. And so, you know, you've kind of put that in a little box for later. Now it's time for me to relax. You know, being able to create that boundary separation with a ritual, like doing a list, is something that can also help.
Cool.
Yeah.
What about the, where did I read this? Maybe Arianna Huffington's book about having pajamas that are just pajamas, like not clothes that you would wear like on your walk in the morning. Is that part of the ritual?
Yeah, that's a great part of the ritual. So that's like stimulus control. You want to be able to associate bedtime with sleep, and whether it's putting on pajamas. I mean, the thing that most people do, the brushing the teeth ritual is like part of it. But the more things you can do to trick your mind into the fact that it should be sleeping now, the easier it's going to be to fall asleep if that's an issue for you.
Got it. And then just couple more questions for you. So I think that something people relate with sleep are dreams. So if I'm dreaming, or I wake up and remember my dreams, I guess we dream every night. At what part of the sleep cycle are we dreaming? And does it mean we're getting a good night's sleep?
Yeah. I mean, so most people don't realize this. You have your vivid dreams in REM. That's the ones you'll probably remember the most. But you'll also actually dream in light sleep. When you're in deep sleep, that's when you're not dreaming, because your brain is like functioning so differently when you're in deep sleep than in conscious life. Mm-hmm. Like when you're in REM sleep, and I were to look at your brain waves right now, they're basically the same as your waking life brain waves. Mm-hmm. Deep sleep is when you wake up and like you don't even know where you are, kind of, if you've ever like had to take like an early airplane flight.
Yeah.
But I don't think that it's really remembering your dreams or not, as far as I'm aware, isn't necessarily a sign of better or worse sleep. I think it's good to interact with your dreams and have like a connection to your subconscious mind. Different substances have been shown to reduce your dreaming. The biggest one being like marijuana, for example. If you smoke marijuana, you're going to not dream as much. So that might not be so great.
Yeah, I just feel like I think about dreams a lot and how life affects dreams and how sometimes they feel so real, sometimes not so much. So it's just interesting how it all relates back to sleep. And this, you know, we spend, I guess it'd be a third of our day sleeping.
And one thing I'm really excited to pursue is this idea of possibly manipulating your dreams. So I don't know if you're familiar with lucid dreaming.
I've heard the term, but I have no idea what it means.
So it's kind of out there to some people, but it's this idea that basically you can become aware while you're dreaming that you're dreaming. There's like this classic movie called Waking Life that explores this, Richard Lakewater. For example, when you're dreaming, you can't read time when you're dreaming. So one way to lucid dream is to create a ritual during the day to always look at your watch. And then eventually you'll do that when you're dreaming, because you basically replay the things that happen the day while you're dreaming. And then you'll realize, oh, I can't read the time. I must be dreaming. So it's like a cue to tell you that. And then you can, you know, fly over the city, have sex with whoever you want. Like, that's the idea, is, you know, maybe living your life through your dreams and taking control of your subconscious mind, but
living vicariously through yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Sure. Why not?
Yeah.
I mean, there's cool. A whole virtual reality world out there in our subconscious minds that we can explore.
Well, that sounds like a whole other conversation. Well, thank you so much for talking. Is there anything about sleep or about what you're researching and your team is about to launch or offer that you want to share?
Sure. I mean, my biggest thing for most people, I would say, just sleep more. You probably need to do it more. And, you know, try out our technology to make it more regenerative. That's really what I would love to be able to show.
Cool. And people can find your app in the App Store, Sonic Sleep Coach, right?
Yeah.
And your website is?
SonicSleepCoach.com. Feel free to schedule an appointment with me. I do like 5 consultations a week. So.
Cool. That's awesome. Well, I'll definitely include all of this information in the show notes along with your link. And then if anything else comes up, we can include it.
Awesome.
Cool. Well, thank you so much. This was enlightening for me, and hopefully I can report back on even better sleep.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, that's it. And if you're hearing this, it means you made it all the way to the end of the episode, and that makes me really happy. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I enjoyed having it. Again, if you liked it, write a review, download, subscribe, or share with a friend. You can find the links to Dan's products in my show notes on my website at haley-miller.com under the podcast tab. You can stay up to date on new episodes by subscribing to my newsletter, following me on Instagram at The Haley Daily, or on Twitter, where I'm trying to be more consistent, at The Haley Daily _. I hope to see you again next time.